make it all true, and you can make it undo. You see, it's easy. You only need to know. Well,
if you want to say. And welcome back to the Sundance Reel on the Weekend. I'm Rick Bruff, and with my co-host Stacy Domalski, and we have a team from the movie HAL, which is not about the computer in 2001.
No.
HAL is, and for film buffs, this is one that, you know, I'm looking forward to. Director Amy Scott and one of the producers, Christine Beebe, and another producer, Brian
Morrow.
Morrow. Okay, and we're talking about to the general public, maybe his films are better known than he is, but like Harold and Maude there, for instance, or Being There, or Shampoo, and talking about Hal Ashby. And Amy, tell us a little bit about what why you wanted to tell this story.
Hal is a seminal filmmaker of the 70s, and the more I started to appreciate his films and research him, I noticed that there wasn't a film about him, and we didn't know sort of what his trajectory was, and he was just an inspirational filmmaker, and so we wanted to know more about him.
And what, tell us a little bit about what did you discover things about Hal Ashby in making the film that maybe you didn't know going in?
Oh, sure, lots of things. Well, we examined his films, and then when we started to uncover a lot of research, we found a lot of audio recordings of Hal. And so that's when we really started to unpack who he was. And he was obsessed with filmmaking. He was obsessed with the craft of filmmaking. He was an Academy Award-winning editor before he was ever a director. Mm-hmm. And so we would run onto these really amazing phrases about his ethos about the craft of filmmaking, which was essentially stay obsessed, be dedicated to your craft. And I just didn't realize to the extent of which his work ethic completely defined who he was.
So how did you get access to a lot of these things that you know, maybe the general public didn't have access to, or you didn't maybe at the time didn't even know that they existed? You know, how did you find what you needed?
We partnered with the Hal Ashby Estate, and that was sort of the first. They literally gave us the key to the castle, to his storage space out in the valley in Los Angeles. And the three of us, my two producers, we rolled out there with some cameras and a U-Haul, and we just started pulling things out, and it was incredible. There was a lot of ephemera that we found. You guys can speak to this too.
Also, when you start researching, it's actually a lot of stuff is there, you know, like at the Academy and stuff, that you just have to look for it. So us, along with another producer, Lisa Jansen, we just started looking, and then you find the tapes. You know, everyone asks, like, but what about Hal? You're going to make a movie about Hal. Do you have anything about Hal? And when we first started, we had nothing. Mm-hmm. And then pretty soon it's like, oh, we have hours and hours of his own voice talking about his own craft. Mm-hmm.
So I'm a filmmaker too, but the thing I do the most is produce. So I'm a producer, and that is a fancy word for the jobs that no one else wants to do when you're on one of the, especially a research project. So like, what is the strangest place you found something of value? You know, you mentioned that you got to go to his estate. I mean, did he like keep tapes in a horse shed or something?
So, I mean, I think the shed the storage space was nuts. There was all those sort of predictable things like posters and, you know, artwork. But there was like, for example, there was a giant file cabinet full of, we opened it and it was full of Beta tapes, and the tapes were labeled with the commercials that Chauncey Gardner watched in Being There.
Oh.
So he kept all of that. Like, that's one example. I mean, and they were, like, hyper-organized, you know, covered in dust. But or, like, bags of clothes from Coming Home that Jane Fonda wore that was still tags and labels on them.
Mm-hmm. So he stole the wardrobe.
Essentially, yeah.
Yeah. I love Harold and Maude. That's one. And so one of the litmus tests of like whoever I date, it came out when I was in college, and this guy asked me out, and he said, "Oh, let's see this movie. I know nothing about it." I loved it. I was mesmerized. I come out, and he goes, "Well, that was the worst." And I looked at him, and I went, "I can't date you anymore." So who are the people that you found around Hal that defined more who he was that we may not have known?
Well, I think we didn't realize how important Norman Jewison was, what an influence that Norman Jewison was. And Brian and I were talking about when we sat down and interviewed Norman, it was really profound experience. All the interviews were, it was just kind of ridiculous that we had that kind of access to these Hollywood legends. So we were always trying to be very mindful of the experience, not just in relation to what they said about Hal Ashby, but just filmmaking in general. And so sitting with Norman was really intense.
What was their relationship?
There was a mentor relationship. Okay. And Norman sort of, we learned that he sort of instilled this value in Hal really early on to not compromise your vision, not compromise your artistic vision. And Hal really lived by that, mm-hmm. By that mantra. And I don't know if it ultimately served him well in the end, but it was his ethos, and it was incredible.
So, Brian, how did you guys get involved with this? This was obviously Amy's vision, and then, boom, there you are.
Amy was working at my company as on a job as an editor, which is
I was editing cat food commercials.
Yeah, Amy was editing some cat food commercials at my company, and she's also mega pregnant, which is I think the technical term for like 9 months pregnant. Yeah, and I hear from the edit bay some sort of shouting. And I went into panic mode thinking I was going to need to, I ran back there and said, "Do we need to go to the hospital?" And you go, "What? No, oh no, I'm not in labor. I just got the official word from the estate that I'm going to be able to make my documentary." And said, "Oh really, what's it about?" And she sort of pitched me on the idea, and I was like, right from the get go, I'm like, wow, that's going to be a really big deal. Like, you're going to, the path that's going to go down is to all these Hollywood greats, and I bet they'd be interested in doing this, which is how it went down. So
you jumped on board right away.
But I didn't have a crew. But I knew how they worked. At Brian's company is they make really, really creative films. And so I had seen the footage since I was editing it, and I knew that we could pull it off with them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was fairly recently I was reading Peter Biskind's book, Easy Riders, Raging Bulls, which is a great gossipy book about all the young Turks and boy wonders of the 70s. And there's kind of a pattern that emerges is that that for quite a few of them there is at some point in the career there's a stumble, and in a couple of cases. The filmmakers recover and they go on to have careers, and others they don't, and they never get back on track. And what happened in that particular case with Hal Ashby? It was like as when the 80s came about. There's you looked at his IMDb list for the 80s, and for it was like he lost his mojo. Somehow, or I don't know if it was him or the industry, the way they treated him, or what happened there, do you think?
I think that the thing was, I don't think that Hal exactly lost his mojo. I think that he was still a really great artist. I think that the industry changed to the extent in the 80s where... And I'll say you should definitely come see the film to find out more about it.
That's a good way to put it.
the studios became corporate, and there was quite a lot less room for somebody who was like an uncompromising, rebellious artist like Hal Ashby was in that environment. And so he didn't thrive in the same way that he did in the 70s, where he was afforded some more room creatively to do what he really wanted to do.
I think in the 70s, they were looking for new and creative voices. And in the 80s, it was franchises, Back to the Future. Yeah. And it was, you're right, it was much more corporate. So does the movie go into that phase then of his life as well?
We do. Yeah, the sort of post being there, there's just a complete descent. And so that's is part of the reason why we made the film. We wanted to know
what happened to this guy.
Yeah. So I'm not going
to
give that away.
No, I don't. I don't want you to, but it is nice to know that it's addressed.
Mm-hmm. It is.
And I think in a way, in a bigger sense, besides it just being a biopic of going through chronologically, this is what he was like in the 70s, this is what he's like in the 80s, in a way, Hal Ashby represents that film movement of the 70s, which is just such a great, for American cinema, it was such a unique time that all those directors working in that way afforded those the ability to make those choices and explore the characters that they were exploring without the studios breathing down their neck so hard. And in that way, Hal Ashby, if he is a personification of that movement was also kind of killed by that corporatization of the studios.
Mm-hmm. He's in the right place at the right time for what he wanted to do. Mm-hmm. It's funny because a lot of those movies, if you do the Hollywood logline or the pitch, nobody is gonna, if you pitch Harold and Maude, it's like, that sounds a little creepy. No. And go ahead.
Well, to that end, they also, every one of his films, they botch the marketing campaign because how do you market a 20-year-old boy falls in love with an 80-year-old woman? What do we do?
Hilarity ensues.
Exactly. Yeah. It's like, what's the campaign
pretty,
on that?
Pretty great lines from Judd Apatow about Harold and Maude and the marketing campaign. Mm-hmm. And how he just can relate to how ridiculous it must have been to try to convince the convince them to, or how panicked they must have been in the marketing that they didn't even put an image at all on the poster. Mm-hmm. The poster is just the words.
We don't know what to do with this.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But they did, and that's part of the, as another brick in the wall of what happened to him. Like they botched the marketing and the landlord. They buried Harold and Maude. That was a cult classic later, but not for him at the time. Mm-hmm. So a lot of those films just really didn't have, they're classics now, but at every step, he did fight with the powers that be.
At least he got them made.
He did.
Yeah. And it's an interesting question. How do you summarize his career? You can't say, John Ford did Westerns or Steven Spielberg does blockbusters, but what's the commonality of being there, Bound for Glory and Shampoo?
I think he just had his finger on the pulse, and he had really pristine taste, and he knew a good script when he saw it. I wouldn't say he's not an auteur, sort of, you have your genre of films, and you're right, he didn't have that. Bound for Glory is nothing like Shampoo. Mm-hmm. and Being There. It's not like The Landlord, but when he had tons of scripts that he constantly workshop, but he knew where the right films were.
Another a thread that kind of came up in doing the interviews, because we did like over 30 interviews for the film, and one of the common things that people said about his filmmaking process as well as the content was that all the stories are very human. And even when you're dealing with kind of almost characters that could easily be caricatures, that he had a way of humanizing them at that level where they became like real roles.
And that would attribute to his direction to those actors.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, you're, for movie buffs, your first chance to see Hal is tomorrow 11:30 at the Mark, and returns Tuesday at the Prospector 8:30 p.m. Again Thursday at the Mark, again in the morning. Little trip down to to the Holiday 2 on Friday at 9:15, and then there's one more chance if you drive down to the Salt Lake on next Saturday at the Broadway 6. So the production team from the movie Hal, thank you very much for coming
by. Our pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you.